Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode number 51 of Material Issues. I'm Mark Hirschberger of Pop Detective Records, and man, I am always glad to see my co-host from the West Coast, International Pop Overthrow President, Mr. David Bash. How are you, my good friend?
How are you, Mark? I'm doing fine.
I'm fantastic. It's a great Wednesday night here in New Jersey. I'm on the other coast. We got a little bit of sunshiny weather, apropos.
Are you walking on it?
I'm walking. I was walking.
You said apropos as I was getting that lame joke out of my mouth.
So. Yeah, it's all good. It's all good. How are you feeling? How you doing, my friend?
No, I'm feeling fine. Rena and I cannot wait to get to Liverpool. We're flying out Friday morning. We're actually flying out of Ontario, California. That was the only viable flight we could get, so we have to go like over an hour to get there, and then we're flying to Atlanta, hanging out there for 3 hours, and then going from Atlanta to Manchester, and then taking the train to Liverpool, which we've done many times. And we absolutely can't wait. We've got more than 100 acts from all over the world playing IPO Liverpool. Wow. we haven't been to the Cavern for 3 years, which is, you know, that's just so weird for us because we've gone every year since 2003.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously COVID prevented that.
I wish I was going with you this year. That would have been nice. But
hey, Andy,
you know, one of these days.
We'll see you, Andy, next week too.
Nice. Yep.
But I've got room in my suitcase. So if you can make it down to Atlanta, we'll put you in there.
Outstanding. I've done that once or twice.
Yeah,
I know. Looking forward to it. Looking forward to possibly talking to you live from the Cavern next Wednesday as well.
That's what we're hoping. I've been assured by one of the manager at Cavern City Tours, the governing body of the Cavern Club, that the Wi-Fi at the Cavern Club has improved quite a bit since I was there in 2019. If that's the case, we should be able to do something live.
For all our viewers, if you've never been to Liverpool and the Cavern Club and Cavern Pub and Matthew Street and whatnot, tune in next Wednesday. And if we can hook it up right, David will give you a tour from inside, underground in the Cavern Club.
We may start a little bit earlier, because, and not that I mind, that it'll be 11 o'clock GMT.
Right, yeah.
Good, us too, Andy. We'll only have an hour and a half before the show's end. Man, that's enough time. We'll see. Yeah. We'll play it by ear, and we'll obviously let everybody know.
Yeah,
but we've got today's show, and in keeping with our rock and roll couples theme, and actually it was never a theme. We just invited Rob and Carney last week. And then I thought, you know what, let's try and do this for, you know, 2, 3, 4, a million weeks with couples. And I thought, well, who better than to ask this next rock and roll couple to be on, partially because they're great. And also because they will be at IPO Liverpool.
Nice.
Next week. So they may be I think they're going to set the record for the soonest time I actually see a guest on Material Issues in real life, which is not a record that anybody would ever care about holding, but I figured I'd mention it anyway.
But it's very cool that they're going to be at IPO Liverpool, which is just, as everybody knows, it's a wonderful festival. So make sure you come out to the Cavern, for how many, 10 days? How many days?
Eight days, 107 acts.
So, wow.
Yeah. It's mind boggling. To introduce this couple, the lady of the couple has been a bass player in many bands over many years, has played on several albums as well. She is now in a duo with her husband and Kim and Lee, and they're great. She also has a band called Gig L, G-I-G-L, I think it's pronounced Giggle or Giggle. She'll
correct. Giggle.
Yeah, we were actually going to have them at IPO Liverpool in 2020, but that didn't happen, and they weren't available this year, so that didn't work out. Well, one day. Anyway, she's great, and her husband, of course, needs no introduction, but I'll give one anyway. founding member of the Soft Boys, founding member of Katrina of the Waves and the Waves, writer of classic songs like Walking on Sunshine and Going Down to Liverpool, which is apropos since they will be going down to Liverpool next week. Obviously still going strong with Kim and Lee, and they're both just the greatest people. So without further ado, would you please give a huge Material Issues welcome to Kimberly Rue and Lee Cave Berry.
Wow.
Hello. Yeah. How are you doing?
We're both fantastic. Nice to see both of you. Wow.
You're in Cambridge? You're in Cambridge now?
St. Ives. It's just slightly north of Cambridge. Yes.
Oh, okay.
So, Very nice. It's a different St. Ives from the one that most people know. But, yes, we were in St. Ives in Cambridge. Just in, it's in Cambridgeshire, isn't it? Yes. So
there I'm we loving are. The hat.
The ID, you know.
I feel underdressed. I gotta find
you. Like the hat, yeah. You wear hat. You're the odd one out, man.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, welcome, guys. Thank you for being on the show. What an absolute pleasure for us, a thrill. And it's neat that we have another, as David said, rock and roll couple. And I gotta say, the two of you look fantastic together. Look at that. Look at that. Yes. Nice.
I love that.
And you'll be appearing at IPO Liverpool. Well, what day are Kim and Lee on, David?
I don't have the schedule.
It's on the Wednesday. It's actually a week today.
Oh, okay.
And we're on, I think we're on at 9:15 in the cavern and 11:15 in the Cavern Bar.
There you go. Wednesday, IPO Liverpool, Cavern and the Pub. Make sure you're there.
That's where we'll be.
Oh, yeah. We will be joined by another soft boy, Maurice Windsor, on the drums.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. In fact, without Robin, we are now the Soft Boys Mark IV, mm-hmm. According to Robin, but Robin won't be there. So it's going to be the Soft Boys Mark IV without Robin. I don't know what mark that is.
The main reason I wanted Robin to be there wasn't because I love his music, which I do, but it was because I wanted to have a shirt off contest to see whose pins and shirts are cooler. Okay. I had people tell me my shirts are even better than Robin Hitchcock's.
So wow.
Have you seen this one?
I've actually had people say that.
I love that one.
Oh, my God. Well, that, that is a great shirt.
It's fabulous on stage. It really comes out. Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to prove to everyone live that I have better shirts than Robin Hitchcock. But now I won't be able to prove that I have a better shirt than Kimberly Rue because
he might be wearing this. You might actually be wearing this on the night.
I'm just going to wear a plain T-shirt then because I'm not worthy.
we're so happy to have you here, and you've got quite a history in music. Many times we go back to the beginning, and we like to find out how both of you kind of got your start in music. And so that's kind of question number one for both of you. At what age did music really kick off for you, and was it a parents thing that kind of, or did you have brothers, sisters? What kicked it off for you?
Well, I must have been about 8 years old, and my parents bought a black and white television, and television was very new, and it was a real kind of prestigious consumer item, not commuter item, if you could afford a TV, and flickering onto the screen came The Shadows, who are kind of maybe not so well known. Oh, yes, you're all nozzy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We're music geeks, so of course we know.
Okay, with their electric guitars, and I kind of knew this was going to be my life.
Yeah.
And did you what did you play first? Did you pick up guitar, or were you piano?
The recorder.
Oh yeah. Wow. Yeah.
That is actually a standard or primary school.
Yeah.
That would be. Is that first grade?
Oh, yeah.
Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
The terminology.
I still have my certificate for grade 3 recorder.
Yeah. Yes, both Lee and Kim both.
Is it framed on the wall back there? Yeah. I think that for most of us got to start, you know?
We're missing out.
Yeah, we haven't used it in any of our music.
No.
Our expertise with the recorder.
Right. I think that's like New Horizons for Kim and Lee, though. I think it's going to be like an all recorder concept somewhere in the pipeline.
So Kim, you went to school with another band that isn't really well known in the States, but of course I know who they are. Episode 6, who I think are really cool.
They're about 5 years older than me, you know. So they were like way out there. You know, I mean they were sort of untouchable. I mean they were like gods, you know. I was completely in awe. Well, I still am, really. But Episode 6 was the school bands. Yeah. And I had a lot to live up to. I mean, we didn't know it at the time, but we were actually in a sort of ferment of, you know, what was going to become the classic. Well, it was already the classic pop era, but it was on the point of becoming the classic albums era, you know, and not only, but. Now, even the younger people now admit that that was the classic albums era, you know. So, which means they know their own stuff isn't as good, which is sad.
That's exactly
which is
right.
Kind of sad. I'd rather it was as good or better, but you know, it's kind of you can be a bit smug about it coming from that era.
Yeah. We're now heritage, we are.
They've got a label for us now. We're now heritage artists.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're in the heritage chants. You know, in the heritage
yeah.
Chants.
It's
such a relief.
Yeah, it's the first time we've had a box, actually.
Yeah, because, I mean, obviously, I know this is like international pop overflow, but, I mean, we have a lot of trouble with the term pop over here.
Yeah, we don't have pop over here. We only have, like, what they feed us with pop, which is always like kind of like what's happening now and who's young and who's doing this and people don't want that from me really.
But unfortunately that's what kids are being fed here too, so
so it's difficult us writing pop and being in the UK and not really having anywhere to kind of be, have a box. So heritage artist is pretty good. At least it is somewhere that we can see. America is so much kind of like, they're always ahead of us. They've been ahead of us for a long time. But and we're always on catch up.
Now, do you get a special license plate for being a heritage artist or
We should, but I'm sure we'll be coming. Allowed to use bus lines
and passes, yes.
Yeah.
Well, if you need a manager, Mark's available.
We certainly need somebody.
Michael, just kind of,
we definitely need people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
We have a people deficit, is what we have. That's why I'm doing the tech.
Yeah. Well, Ken, did you actually go to a school called Jesus College?
That's like what we call college education. You know, so there's school and there's college, and there's a thing called Cambridge University, and it's divided into colleges. And they are like medieval in origin. They are what 600-800 years like old, these institutions. So, you know, and they have, you know, they have the sort of religious names, you know, that were kind of appropriate to the time, and you know, maybe appropriate now. But I mean, yeah, this one was called Jesus Christ.
Yeah,
but it's got things like
Emmanuel and Christie, so they're all sort of Cambridge Oxford College.
They're not theological colleges, you know. They're sort of general.
Right.
I mean, it's something like Harvard or something like, you know, except obviously Harvard doesn't have a kind of a religious title in it. It's the name of the guy who started it or whatever.
Yeah. But I mean, we know, I mean, the states, Oxford and Cambridge are both very famous. You know, some of our students end up, doing foreign exchange and going to Cambridge. And so we know.
Absolutely. You know,
we're all very aware of that.
I mean, you are where we get all our best rowers from. I mean, for a start.
Yeah, that's right.
I can't take any credit for that. I'm a terrible rower. I went to Moses University. No, I didn't.
You got it. I mean, people say I went to Cambridge, but then if you live in either Cambridge or Oxford, you will say which college, because you kind of know which. Yeah, like Jesus is quite a well-known college in Cambridge and one of the oldest. And also Prince Charles went there?
Prince Edward went there.
Wow. Okay, so, and I think the oldest one is Peterhouse, which my mum used to work at as a fellow's secretary. So, yeah, so basically the different, but he went to Jesus.
I didn't know there was a subsect like that. I knew of Hogwarts.
Hogwarts, Cambridge. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's basically the same in principle.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of, yeah, guys in like buildings with kind of spiky turrets on them and guys wearing kind of weird gowns and uniforms. So, yeah, it's exactly like that, and that's all there is to it.
But interestingly,
Lee, did you say you also went to Cambridge?
I was born in Wales, but when I was one, my parents came to Cambridge. So I've actually, you know, was kind of more or less, I grew up here, really. So yes, I have been to Cambridge.
I meant university, I'm sorry.
I did Open University, actually. So I got my degree with the Open University eventually. So yeah, there you go. Now you know. And it was a science degree. So Kimberly did archaeology and ancient languages.
Yes, and I'm training to become a fossil.
The great thing about being married to an archaeologist is the older you get, the more interested he becomes.
I forget
rings, right? Yeah.
You talk about an archaeologist. I forget your answer. I was watching the American Bandstand with Dick Clark, and he asked you, "What are you? You're an archaeologist?" I forget what you said, something about rocks or something. I forget what your answer was.
Probably, yeah.
It's still rocks. Yeah, still rocky, isn't it? Yeah.
Did you plan to become an archaeologist, Kim, or did you know you were going to be a musician?
Well, I knew I wanted to be a musician. I didn't know if it was going to be possible. You know, it was a very distant, I mean, of actually being up on the stage, you know, and making some sort of impression on anybody. You know, that seemed very remote, you know, and I tried for quite a long time and tried quite hard. And in that time, I might have considered diverting into archaeology, but I drifted back to the music and continued trying hard and slowly.
When did you start writing music, though? I mean, it's obvious. It's obviously it's in your DNA. I mean, you have it. You have the talent. It's there. So, at what age did you say, "Well, I can start. I can do this kind of thing"?
Must have been about 14, maybe. I kind of figured out that, you know, I wasn't a kind of a front man, a band leader, a lead singer, you know, any of those. But I could, you know, rather than just being, I mean, there are loads of guitarists. I mean, even then, you know, there were like kids in the school who could play the guitar. And, you know, I was just one of those. But I figured out maybe I could be a guitarist who writes songs. So like, there would be something unique. And that's kind of stayed with me.
Yeah, when we first got together, I kind of met his friend Cole Michaels from school. And he took me to see Cole playing in, you know, various places. And Kimberly kind of played a guest spot with Cole. And every time I saw Cole, he did a song at the end that Kimberly wrote at school.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't keep playing this song, but I mean, another guy in my class kept playing it.
Decades later, 30 years of my life. Here's what I found really interesting, and I'm reading this from your website. You know, when after you'd formed the Waves, you had a gig at Alex Wood Hall in Cambridge, you had the Waves, and Lee, you were in a band called Blotto. Did you meet each other? Was there chemistry right from the beginning? Because you didn't get together for another 20 years or so.
Well, I don't think there was really, was there? Wasn't. I think the problem was, as I was going out with somebody else and Kimberly was going out with somebody else. So when you're in that situation, anyone you meet then kind of goes into a friend box, doesn't it? Everybody has like a friend box. And Kimberly went into the friend box, right? And it wasn't until 20 years after that, when we first met, that the friend box wasn't relevant anymore. Well, actually, what it was, somebody mentioned to me that he might like me, and I wasn't going out with anybody, and he wasn't going out with anybody. And then suddenly it kind of all fell into place. But before that, he was in the friend box. Ah. And it takes a bit of time to get out of that. Well,
Had you run into each other since that gig? Or
yeah, absolutely. Over the years, yeah. We both lived in Cambridge, so right. You know, so we're both part of the Cambridge scene. So I would see him playing in local bands like The Lonely occasionally, and I would play it. Yeah, I was mostly local anyway, and we'd sometimes meet in the street and wave and go, oh, hi, you do, how are you doing, and catch up and all that. And he was always very friendly. I can remember doing an audition in London for a band called the Body Snatchers at the time, who became the Bell Stars. I didn't get that job. But opposite that particular night, Kimberly was playing with the Soft Boys, because I knew them. I popped over sort of around soundcheck time, and Kimberly was there and gave me Underwater Moonlight and a couple of singles, and got them Underwater Moonlight. He got signed by Morris and Robin, and himself, of course. But Matthew wasn't there yet. And then when we got together 20 years later, I took my copy of Underwater Moonlight and got Matthew to sign it.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, there you go.
I love it.
Yeah, but he was very nice to me then as well. He's sweet.
Oh, I love this. You two are a lot like me and Rena. So,
that's good. Yeah. Yeah, love is...
So there's still hope for me. I just got to find someone who's been in the friend zone for 25 years.
There you go. Yeah. That's the way to do it. Yeah.
I know a few. Kim, when did you meet Robin, and how did you meet him?
Well, Robin turned up in the local music scene in Cambridge in about 1975, and he was different, you know. I mean, it very quickly became apparent that he was different. And I mean, he was quite active, you know, and he always did, you know, he wrote his own songs, and he always delivered the goods. You know, there's always a song that's worth hearing, you know, with a nice solid vocal, you know, like solid guitar accompaniment. And it very quickly became apparent that this was a man to be reckoned with. And you know, the Soft Boys started up, and so, you know, and this was at sometimes like The Waves, the sort of very early version of Katrina and the Waves. And You know, so, I mean, we, you know, we became friends. You know, like pretty much all the wives and all the soft boys were friends. I mean, you know, Roger Jackson was like a member of the Waves, and, you know, he became a member of Robin Hitchcock's Egyptians. You guys have done your homework, haven't you? And, you know, for example, and, you know, eventually I joined the soft boys, and, you know, I was around, I mean, we had two albums, like, during the lifetime of the bands. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and a few posthumous things, of course, but, you know, I was around for those two albums.
One of the best reviews I ever saw of an album was of Underwater Moonlight. At the end of the review, it said, "Go out and buy three copies, like, immediately." I actually went out and bought one because of that review.
That album, it does get fantastic reviews. It gets reissued every few years, and there's a spate of praise, you know, and then it kind of, and that's it's the life that it has, you know. It's you know, and that may well go on, you know, long after all the soft boys are dead.
It has long.
I'm waiting for the box set. I'm sure that I'm waiting for the 5-disc box set with all the outtakes. I'll be all over that.
Yeah, I've heard a few of those. I mean, they've actually I think we had to kind of brush up on a song from Underwater Moonlight. For some reason we downloaded the whole box set or something with all the outtakes. And you know, when you put your music on in the car, you get the random playlist. And then all these Underwater Moonlight outtakes keep jumping up. And, you know, a lot of them actually are of us rehearsing, you know, and we had a cassette recorder, and that we had a PA system with three microphones and like in a direct out socket. And that was one channel of the cassette. And then we had another microphone just in the room, and that was the other stereo channel. So, I mean, a lot of these bonus tracks, that's actually just us rehearsing. And like recording ourselves on the cassettes, you know, and there's songs like Goodbye Steve or Morris, or which, you know, we never finished. I mean, it was different every time we rehearsed it. And it was never really satisfactory either. And, you know, that's all there is, you know, with that song. And, you know,
how do you feel? How do you feel in particular when that stuff comes out and you know you're listening to it and saying, "Oh my God, this has just been unleashed to the world"? Or are you thinking, "Oh, that's great. I'm glad people are getting to hear this"?
Well, some of it, I don't know. I mean, you can see why the Underwater Moonlight album have the songs that are on it and not those songs.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, it's like sooner or later you've got to say one song is better than another, you know, or at least it's going to, like, people are actually going to connect with it.
I was thinking that perhaps you might say that actually when you listen to those, you think, "Did I play on that?"
That's true.
But you can see the fascination of fans of the music, you know, that you like to hear all the outtakes and all the, just to see where everything came from, because you're a fan. But as an artist, we've talked to people that cringe sometimes when you talk about outtakes and things. Mm. Like, "Oh, I didn't," but they're maybe too close to it, you know.
You've got to have some sort of quality control, you know. You cannot expect people, like, every time you pick up a guitar, for that to be recorded and then made available to the universe.
Actually, I think that's changed. I think that's what's changed about being young. I think now you have to kind of let it go, you know, because you go to a gig and people are recording it and putting it on, you know, YouTube and putting it on their Facebook sites, and so you're playing live. Yeah. So you can't first of all, you can't change what you like on the night. And you look back at these videos sometimes, you think, "Why did I wear that?" and, you know, and you think, "Oh no, there's a really bad mistake I made there." And you can just drive yourself completely crazy like that. You just have to control your own output. That's all you can do.
You know, before the cell phones that could take video, it was always no videotaping. And if anybody tried, it was always like a camcorder they were trying to hide under their shoulder or something. And nowadays... Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, you can't actually see the artist because of people holding their phone up in front of you.
Everybody's doing this, yeah.
I actually walked out of a Tom Jones gig because the people in front of me just kept putting their phones in front of Tom. So what's the point, you know? You might as well go home and listen to a record.
And there's also been the argument that, you know, some clubs and venues are starting to grasp it, is they're going to film. They're going to actually professionally film the show. Yeah. And tell everybody, we'll give you a link to download the whole video for free. Just enjoy being there. Absolutely. And then download everything and forget your phone, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and if they did kind of sweeps of the audience at the same time, then everybody would be happy. I mean, the point is what they're trying to do is to validate the fact that they were actually there. So having the official video is all very well, but it doesn't include them.
Yeah,
right. People want to be included nowadays. So the best thing to do is say, look, okay, we're going to do sweeps of the audience. You can wave. You know, we'll tell you when it's going to happen. You can wave and say, yes, I was here. And you can say, look, here's the video and there am I.
Social media has made everybody into a narcissist.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely it has. Yes, absolutely.
Speaking of narcissists, just kidding. When Soft Boys played, I mean, was Robin doing those spontaneous monologues in between?
He does them anyway. He's a natural at it, and half of the people that go and see him want those. It's extraordinary. I've been a Soft Boys fan for a really long time. Okay. Sure. And I have been a Robin fan been a Kim Roo fan for a really, really long time. But I've also been a Robin fan for a really long time. And that is an amazing part of his show. But he just goes off and you think that this is amazing. He's making this up as he goes along. It's just extraordinary. And it goes places and it challenges you. You know, you have to kind of go with him and fight. And he's very funny. He's so good. He can do that with his guitar as well. He's very, you know, his guitar solos are completely unique. Nobody plays like Rob. And Kimberly, nobody plays like Kimberly. And when they play together, it's extraordinary.
Speaking of nobody plays like Kimberly, your guitar style, I say it's kind of like attacking the guitar in many ways. You have an edge, you know.
I'm glad it's coming over. I mean, the edge is coming over. Yeah. I think there's maybe two things going on there. There's, firstly, I don't have a sort of naturally loud or attacking voice. You know, but I mean, you've got to have something which kind of bites, you know, rock and roll. And I'm kind of depending on the guitar to supply that. Also, I think there has to be an edge on there because, I mean, I'm a songwriter and I'm trying to sort of indicate, you know, as I play, so that the band, you know, where the song is going, you know, where the kind of corners are, you know, and the...
Yeah.
The kind of fence posts, if you will, of like the journey along that particular road.
Yeah. I mean, he's got a terrifically cutting sound, Kimberly. Yeah. He plays very cleanly.
Yep.
A lot of the times, if he plays with another guitarist, the other guitarist feels that perhaps Kimberly's a bit louder than him, but actually he isn't. He's just clearer. He just cuts through. Also, the other thing that Kimberly has that most people don't have is like 10% more pazoing. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's so much energy in what he does. But it's extraordinary being on the stage with Kimberly because you can just feel it, that extra energy that he has. So, yeah.
Yet I have to say, he has a very soft side too. My favorite song that you've ever written, Kim, is Fishing.
Oh, okay.
That's really my favorite song of yours.
Pick that one out.
We were listening to his song Jess in the car. I love that song. That is so beautiful. It's so lyric. It's almost folk, and it's just beautiful. It's because I've had a friend who's passed, and it's just so such a beautiful song. And he writes such brilliant romantic songs as well. He's written these such lovely romantic songs.
Fishing is just beautiful in its simplicity. I love it. So anyone who doesn't own Kimberly's album, The Bible of Bop, go find it.
Oh, Pop, yep.
It's great. Well, while I'm thinking of it, Lee, I have to ask you, how did you end up opening for Fats Domino? Because that's amazing.
Okay. Well, I went down to London and did interviews, sort of auditions, as I said, because I did the Bell Stars one. But before that, I'd been before, and I did an audition for a band called Mean Streets. And when I did that interview or that audition, there was a guy there who like seemed really biz. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I was only 20, so quite young, or 19, I think, at the time. And he kept on asking me all these interested questions about where I got my bass from, how long I've been playing, and all that. And he was the manager of Mean Streets. And then he called me up after. He says, "Well, I don't want you for Mean Streets." He said, "I want you for my band." That's quite good, actually. And his name was Mal Gray, and he was in a band called the Wild Angels in the 60s, as well as being in Shannon for a while. Okay. So he's quite, you know, a fairly well-known singer anyway, and he was getting into promotions, so he kind of organized the tours in Europe for Bill Haley and Fats Domino. Wow. But he always had himself and his band as the support act, because obviously then he could manage and actually be there and actually play as well. And so he took me out on his next tour with Fats Domino. So we did that. And that was extremely exciting for a 20-year-old.
Wow.
Nerve-wracking. And when I got back, I was exhausted. And two years later, he said, "Actually, you were the best bass player we ever had on the phone."
Wow.
He'd play that, wouldn't he? Yeah. And he said, "Will you come and do rehearsals? Because Bill Haley's coming over." So I said, "Yeah, okay." So we went up to London and we started rehearsals for Bill Haley coming over. And then Bill Haley died.
Yeah.
And I think Bill Haley heard that he was going to have a female bass player. That's why.
Yeah, back in his day, that was unheard of. That's true.
That's my fault. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's all my fault, right? I was nearly Bill Haley's bass player for a bit.
That alone is like rock and roll story enough for most people's lifetimes. I was nearly Bill Haley's bass player.
Exactly.
And then he died.
It wasn't my fault.
Exactly.
All right. Speaking of other female musicians, Kimberly, when did you meet Katrina, and how did that happen?
Well, after the Soft Boys, I gave Alex Cooper a call, who the drummer of the Waves and Katrina.
Alex was. Cooper, not Alice Cooper.
Yeah,
Alex. Yeah, very similar name.
Yeah,
and. Yeah,
big
I mean,
fan of Alice.
Alex and I were in the same year at college. And Alex introduced me to Vince and Katrina, who joined Katrina and the Waves. And they're what they call American Air Force brats. That is, there's around the Cambridge area in the east of England, there's a lot of American air bases, and they bring like their families with them, and both Vince and Katrina were from American Air Force families, so they were kind of hanging around the Cambridge area, you know, like with a lot of talent and in a sort of circuit, you know, like occasionally you know, playing on, at the airbase, you know, and we kind of, but without any original songs at that stage, although, you know, later on they wrote original songs. And, you know, without us any sort of roots of the kind of wider music world. So, you know, well, that's when we have the two British, two American lineup of that, that particular four-piece band.
And it's interesting because you started off, as I start looking at the history, as the Waves, and I was listening to the first single, The Nightmare, which when you followed up a little bit later with Brown Eyed Son, I mean, those two songs are like night and day. It's like you're the Nightmare was really kind of like a punk pop edgy, the way a lot of the songs of that day kind of just kind of grated on you a little bit. And then Brown Eyed Son all of a sudden was this very melodic, beautiful vocals and the harmonies. It just seemed to change overnight almost.
And they both your songs?
Well, they're both my compositions.
Okay, because it's quite interesting with Kimberly because he doesn't write in the same style all the time.
Yeah.
And actually, when I write, I don't write in the same style all the time because we listen to pop music, which does have all sorts of styles. So we listen to pop music, and if there's a good reggae tune in the top 20, we go, hey, yeah, this is really good, you know. And if there's a good country, because in the UK, it's like in America, they had different charts all the time. So they had the country charts and they had the pop charts and then they had the blues charts. And whereas in the UK, we just had the one chart. So they were all in that chart. So that's what we think of as being pop music.
Yeah.
And so that's
how it was when I was growing up in the States. That's exactly how it was. I mean, you could hear 1970 is the year I kind of came of age listening to Top 40. And you could hear Led Zeppelin, followed by the Carpenters, followed by Johnny Cash, followed by the Jackson 5, and it was all pop.
Exactly, and that's what
all good.
Yeah, and all good, and that's what good, we kind of grew up with, and that's what we write. So you can't say we're blues because we're not just blues. You can't say we're folk because we're not just folk. We have different things that we write about because of when we grew up, and in different styles.
I think part of the point I was getting to, though, listening to the early stuff of the Waves, and then it kind of developed quickly into the Brown Eyed Son, which then developed into your self-financed first record, which really was, you know, more of a pop, you know, oriented sound than what the early stuff was. I mean, was that a conscious development towards something that's going to be a little?
That time you've picked out, that was actually. I mean, like I wrote, I think The Nightmare, I sort of came along to, you know, Katrina and the Waves, you know, with that song. And, you know, then I arrived in Katrina and the Waves and Katrina was there. And it very quickly became apparent that, you know, there was kind of, we had a star sort of in our midst, you know, and, you know, like excellent singer and a very dynamic front person. And, you know, then I wrote Brown Eyed Son, and that's kind of I'm in there, you know, like doing the harmonies with Katrina.
And how did you end up getting connected to Attic Records, which is fascinating because they're a small Canadian label?
Well, the Soft Boys actually, like Underwood's Moonlight originally came out on a small British label called Armageddon, and there was very little, there was a you know, obviously very few people were buying that, and over here in the UK, and there was a little bit of export to, again, a very few people in the US and in Canada, and there was like one licensing deal to like maybe an equivalent little label in Canada, which was Attic. So they put out Underwater Moonlight in I think that was the only country and the only label actually during the lifetime of the Soft Boys which actually licensed a Soft Boys record. So and then not only that, but they actually kind of kept that connection, you know, when Katrina and the Waves came along, you know, we had a self-financed album. I mean, the only kind of licensing deal we got with that, once again, was Attic, you know. And actually, the first time Katrine the Waves did like a legitimate kind of tour, you know, with like press and like legitimate gigs, you know, like the Bamboo Club in Toronto and so on. And, you know, like actually had a record out and was getting played on the radio, it was actually in Canada, you know, and that was like before Walking on Sunshine was a hit. So, you know, all credit to them. I mean, they found it first.
It's Ralph Alfonso, wasn't
and,
it?
And yeah. It's the same man, job, which is Ralph Alfonso.
And now, I know you guys talk about your shirts and everything, but yeah, my connection to Attic Records, you know, calling occupants of Interplanetary Craft, which was Klaatu out of Canada, all their reissues were on Attic Records. So this is as close as I can get to a connection to you guys, my shirt. So I want to bring up something. I don't have a hat on. I got to bring
up. I have to bring the t-shirt up. So they can't even see mine.
You've more than made up for the hat.
You've made up for the hat.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. Did you know that Walking on Sunshine was going to be in the film High Fidelity, or did that completely take you by surprise?
We didn't necessarily know about all the films and TV commercials and that song kind of turned up in. But I mean, actually, I think I think the book came out first, didn't it?
Oh, it did. Oh, is it in the book too?
And then somebody told me, hey, there's this scene in High Fidelity, you know, the new Nick Hornby novel, where there's a scene. Well, I mean, a lot of it takes place like in an independent record store, you know, and the two guys, and the sort of friction between the two guys, and the whole kind of culture of like, you know, being a fan of like, you know, like, there's certain bands, you know, being horrified that, you know, somebody's a fan of another band's, you know, that very tribal thing. And eventually the film came along, you know, Jack Black does that kind of tribal guy brilliantly, you know, he mercilessly bully people who don't like the bands he likes, if he possibly can. And, you know, to his credit, you know, he actually put on, there's this scene where he puts on Walking on Sunshine in the store at like 9 o'clock in the morning or something, and which is like, you know, too much for the. There's a romantic lead character as well, which is the John Cusack character, who actually has girlfriends.
No, I mean, that's perfect record store day culture stuff, as you were talking about. But, the difference in personalities and what they're, you know, what they're playing and why they're playing it and who it's cool to be a fan of and who it isn't.
Kimberly's just written a new song for our next album, which is going to be just exactly as irritating in the morning to people who don't like morning. In fact, slightly more so, because it's a real celebration of morning, if you understand my meaning.
That's great. I can't wait to hear it. I want to go back to what you mentioned about the variety on your albums. That's something that has always stuck out as a hallmark of a Kim and Lee album. And that's something that a lot of young bands aren't doing. I mean, I love, as you know, I love pop music that's being done by current bands. And some of them are just really amazing. But if you listen to their albums, the one thing that's very common, that's different from when the albums that came out when we were growing up, is they glom onto one particular style, and they all their songs are in that style. They don't sound exactly the same, but they're all that kind of song. I wish that, you know, you look at a band like the Beatles, and they were influenced by so many different genres, and you can certainly tell in their songs. Your albums are very similar to that, and that's very much a breath of fresh air. I wish more bands would do that, but, you know, they find one style they like, and that's it, you know.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that's so much what's happening. I think that's kind of how the music industry is channeling it. Because we've found that. I mean, we've been doing albums for 20 years or so, and that it's been difficult to place the tracks. because we're not in a genre. It's really because now we could just turn around and say, okay, let's just take this track and put it in the blues people's hole, and then let's take this track and put it in the folk people's hole, and then yeah, that would be okay. But the problem is because we aren't actually of that genre, they're not in that. Yeah, they don't seem to want to pick it up because there's only like one song on our album that's like that.
That's why
the heritage has worked for us because they get that you get it as well. But it is that kind of pop thing where you don't have to be the same, but it is actually quite difficult to market, and to get it. So I don't blame the younger bands for choosing a genre and sticking to it, because that's the only channel you can get noticed.
Right,
is to go through, to get into a box and get played on. If you can do blues, you can get played on a blues chat radio. If you're folk, you can get played on folk. You can get gigs doing folk. You can get gigs doing blues. Everybody's very interested in the box, but I can understand why they do that, because that everybody is so genre orientated. Spotify, Apple Music. You have to kind of put the genre in, and then it's kind of difficult if you've got an album that's a pop album that isn't actually one genre.
And speaking of marketing, going across the bottom of the screen, kimberlyrue.co.uk. What a great website. You can find everything about not only Kim, but Kim and Lee, and everything's on there. It's a wonderful website. So I encourage anybody to check out the website, scrolling across the bottom, and you'll find everything you need to know about these two individually and as a couple. Just wanted to bring that up real quick, so they knew.
Thank you. That's great. Thank you very much.
Kim, here's a question about going down to Liverpool. When the Bangles covered it, they made one very noticeable lyric change, changing human body to UB40.
That was the original lyric.
Pardon?
That was the original lyric.
Oh, UB40 was the original lyric?
Then
Human Body was in, I thought that was in one of the Katrina versions, no?
No.
No, that wouldn't make sense.
Do you know what UB40 is, David?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. You do? Yeah, okay. I'm not sure the Bangles even knew what the UB40 was. When they sang the song, but yeah.
They were Anglophiles, so they probably did.
They probably did know. Yeah, they probably knew.
Maybe I just thought she was singing a Human Body. I don't do drugs, but sometimes I'm in those weird places.
So. Oh, you used to, right?
And you still think it's excuse me while I kiss this guy?
Exactly.
It isn't.
Exactly.
It's not that. The archetypal mystery, isn't it?
Yeah, my sister will hate me, but when I was a teenager, we were in this park once, and she looked over at this. Now this is fairly English, I have to say, but she looked over at this big shaggy dog, and she said, "Oh look, that's a Durex dog." Okay, now in England at the time, Dulux was a paint. Okay, and this big shaggy dog used to advertise it in the yeah, and then of course Durex is something completely different.
Right, yeah.
So yeah, I have to explain that. I'm sorry. Very, very easy for people in the UK, that one.
Oh, I love it. So, I mean, rewinding a tiny bit, though, Walking on Sunshine was massive. And it seems to have never died out. It just seems to have a song that has incredible staying power. I mean, what does that feel like? I mean, massive song. And that is just incredible. I mean, anybody wished one time in their life to write something one-tenth as impactful as a song like that.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm just so, I'm so thankful about my whole life, really. I mean, I've had a wonderful life. And, I've done what I wanted to do. I've played music. I've even been paid for it. And so it's given me everything I've got in my life. And you know, part of, you know, part of that music has actually kind of, you know, got across to the wider public, you know. And, yeah. You know, but at the same time, I mean, it's kind of nice because Walking on Sunshine, it's, I think we managed to capture something of that original spirit of rock and roll, you know, and then the 1960s, you know, and even though it was 1985. And, you know, I'm very glad it, I'm very glad Walking on Sunshine doesn't sound like a typical song of the 1980s. Put it
that way. No, no, exactly. And I think that's why it has the staying power that it does. It does. It doesn't automatically say, well, that's 1985. You know, it doesn't say that. It's coming back again and again. And I was talking to David before we, you know, we brought you guys up here, before you got live. For a lot of people, all they know from Katrina and the Waves really is Walking on Sunshine. Mm-hmm. You had to make your Eurovision when Love Shine a Light. But yeah, when you say Katrina and the Waves, it's Walking on Sunshine. But people really listen to everything you've done. Such a good band, such a tight band,
especially those Attic albums. Yeah,
right. Just such great songs, and that's why David and I love to do this show, because it really highlights more than just a singularity of a lot of artists. Like you need to look at the complete picture, and your picture grew into Kim and Lee as well, it's a whole palette that people need to explore, and that's why we enjoy doing this. Yeah,
and that reminds me, Kim, I need some of your solo albums, so can you bring some to Liverpool?
Thank you.
We are trying to downsize.
So what's the future? What's the future for Kim and Lee as a band? You're gonna play as long as Bill Haley did until you drop? Or
I really hope so. But I mean, it's pretty intense right now. I mean, you know, the live shows are, you know, going through the roof, and you know, we're doing as much as we possibly can. And as I say, there has been, you know, it's actually right now, as we're talking, it's actually the 25th anniversary of Love Shine a Light. So I mean,
wow,
we're
incredibly
busy.
Happy anniversary.
With that.
Yeah, and I need, before I forget, I need to ask you about that one particular, I mean, a great song, but I watched a video on YouTube the other day where you did it with Martin Newell. And Martin Newell is one of my favorite artists of all time. How did that come about?
Oh, well, off you go.
Martin Newell is actually a contact of mine and friend, actually, because I went out when I was after being in Cambridge and watching Soft Boys and going out with a boyfriend that was at the time. I actually started going out with a guy called Tony Phillips, who was the bass player of Jip, which was Martin Newell's band at the time.
These guys have heard of Jip.
That's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Genius.
I've got the metal set of Jip right here somewhere, yeah.
Okay. Well, I was a big fan of Jip as well. So, I did lights for them for a while, because when I moved to Ipswich to be with Tony, I didn't have a band. I obviously played before that, but I didn't have a band in Ipswich. I wasn't obviously in the band when I left. So I thought, well, I'd rather do lights for a band that I really like than play for a band that I didn't. So I did lights for Jip for ages. So me and Martin are quite good. I never actually played, the only time I ever played with Martin in that period was at the end of Jip. In fact, it was after Jip. And he wrote a song for Southwood and Ferris, right? and Tony can make it. He was doing something in the studio. He was working very much with Dave Hove's studio at the time, and he couldn't make this gig that Martin was going to play this song. And so he said, why don't you get Lee to do it? So I actually drove the guys in my Mini Traveller, right, to to South Woodham Ferris, right? I mean, this is a six-foot guy in the back with all the gear. So I had one of these mini travels with the back down, you know. And Martin was in the front with me, and then the two other guys, the drummer and the guitarist Max, they were in the back. With it down and then all the gear in the back, and then this poor little mini was going on the other side. Just it was extraordinary. And not only that, I had a puncture on the way there, on all the way back, I can't remember which one it was, and they had to help me change a tire. And in fact, Martin writes about that in his autobiography.
Yeah,
one of the stories he writes about. So yes, we're still friends, you know. We still talk.
Wow. Well, you know what, Lee? You and Kim attract some of the most delightful eccentric characters. So
we do. Love that. Yeah, we do. Yes, it's the music that does it. Yeah.
He did a great job singing that song. I couldn't believe it. It popped up, and I was like, "Wait, this is Martin." Yeah.
I mean, I mean, there was a guy there at the gig actually doing real good quality video. Yeah. There's different camera angles and that.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, we saw this thing back and it was all like in tune, you know, and everything. We couldn't believe it. You know, like all the vocals were in tune.
And the lights were brilliant, weren't they?
It's great. It's a fantastic
mistakes. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. And I do have to bring up I do have another connection to you. I own Pop Detective Records, just a little advertisement, but one of my artists had a very good run with Do You Want Crying, which Vince De La Cruz wrote. They covered that, and it was the coolest song in the world on Sirius XM. And
So
that's my connection to Katrina and the Waves as well, besides, you know.
Vince is a good writer.
Is that the Dolmens, Mark? Or?
That's the Dolmens. Yeah, they did a cover of "Do You Want Crying?" And
Vince wrote "Sun Street" as well, didn't he?
Yep.
He's a good writer. Yeah.
Well, listen, this has been amazingly delightful. You guys, you're adorable as a couple, and very, very talented as musicians. And it's been an honor to have you. And I'm certainly looking forward to seeing you a week from today.
Great.
We cannot wait. So,
and I wish I was going to Liverpool, but you know, if I get there next year, I hopefully will have a chance to see you guys myself and say hi. And it'd be wonderful. It'd be wonderful. But conversely, if you ever decide to come to the States and tour around a little bit, Philadelphia area, you know,
or Los Angeles for that matter.
I've got some good friends in Los Angeles, actually. Eric Sandberg. Do you know Eric Sandberg?
I don't.
No. Okay. He's good. And also, the guy who played the Gorn in Star Trek, Bobby Clark.
I don't know him, but I know him.
There you go.
Stay happy, stay healthy, keep doing what you're doing. Purple Kittens was great. We look forward to what's coming next. And as we tell everybody, right there's the website. Check them out. Check out everything they've done. You won't be sorry. Thank you so much for being on Material Issues, episode number 51. What a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you for all your great music and just being who you are.
See you next week.
Absolutely.
We're looking forward to it. Thanks so much.
As am I. Have a good night.
Good night, my friend.
Good night. Thank you so much for asking us.
Thank you.
Well, David, there you go.
They're wonderful, yeah.
Absolutely wonderful couple, and both so talented in their individual rights, and they've done so much, and the future looks like that it's going to hold a lot more things for them as well. So I hope everybody comes out to Liverpool next Wednesday to the Cavern and the Cavern Pub and checks out International Pop Overthrow with you there in Liverpool, and of course with Kim and Lee and Rena.
I was hoping she might come in and join us, but you know, she's working from home and has phone meetings like all day, so she couldn't escape. But you know, we'll see her in Liverpool. Thank you, Andy.
Thank you, Andy. Yeah,
we'll see you in Liverpool.
It's just
for Sylvia. Yes.
Really nice. That was a great show. I absolutely thrilled to talk to the two of them, and big fan. Wonderful.
Yes. Well, I don't have, I wish I could say I have guests to announce for the succeeding weeks. Right now we don't, which is fine. We'll get them. I've just been so busy with IPO, especially Liverpool, that I've been somewhat remiss in going after guests, and Mark's been busy as well. So, but we will, and you know, until we do, we can always do the show together and, you know, be fun as we always are. But next week we'll be at the Cavern in Liverpool, and if what the manager says is true, we'll have good enough Wi-Fi to at least try to do a broadcast from there, which would be our first IPO broadcast on material issues. So let's hope for the best. And in the meantime, everyone, you know, be well, be safe, and thank you all very much for listening.
And stay tuned right here on the Facebook group. Tell your friends, join the group, join us over at the YouTube and materialissues.com. Then you'll know what's happening next week and all the succeeding Wednesdays after that. Next week will be show number 52. One year. Full of shows. And all the archives are on YouTube and here on Facebook. So if you missed any of our great artists and guests, you can go back and check out all those shows, including tonight's show. So everybody have a great night. Stay safe, stay happy, healthy. David, love to you and Rena. We will talk to you really soon from Liverpool.
You indeed you will. Take care, Mark.
Good night.
Good night.